The Atiya side of the gorge was mentioned. And Bob came up steaming to Danny Miles, who was the MC telling the story. That's not what happened. And then I've run into Bob before, but there's a group called the Old Timers that meets. Roger Martin, who was the in the legislature, he was the minority leader. He's one of the ones Bob recruited in 64 to run and change everything.
And
I got invited to go to those things, and so I met Paquette.
Great.
And said, so, I really need to talk to you, because you have this, you're steaming about this thing. So, about 2015, it's like about 2 years ago, I sat down with him. He had parts of his diary.
Yeah.
And as a historian, say, and so he read from his diary, he answered questions, he brought me clippings of editorials, he tried to box Vic in by having editorials. All the editorials he gave me were from actually before the date, so they couldn't have been part of the boxing.
Yeah.
But so it was a, bit, but it was a fascinating discussion.
Yeah.
And so it's a big, giant project. I'm literally, I have probably written the last bit, and I've got to fill in little pieces.
Sure.
But the first draft is like 1,670 pages. There will be some editing going on.
Evidently.
And I didn't do the natural resources until I kind of finished it in December.
Yeah.
And I couldn't talk to you until I have all this stuff in my head.
Sure.
That kind of stuff. And so I'm just trying to put the pieces together. And it's clear there's different views and everything else. And you're in the middle of it. I know that you met with Victor several times.
Sure.
Going down to the office and things. And so, you know, that's where we are.
Yeah.
All this is recorded. It's archival quality. It'll eventually go in the Atiya archive.
Sure.
Pat was the only one who wouldn't let me record it.
Interesting, yeah.
Which given, yeah, I can see that. But it's like, you know, give it up.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we are.
Well, you mentioned the Atiya side, and I'm curious what that was.
Sure, sure. So he's got two things, and one I'm going to take out of the book unless I can find any other support for it.
Yeah.
He's an Oregonian who grew up loving the gorge.
That's right.
As everybody else, he tells a great story. When he was in high school in 1940, he went to some national convention. He's coming back on the train. He wakes up as they're going through the gorge. It's like, oh, my gosh, it's wonderful. And he's a Portlander. So
and he told me that story.
It's his stuff.
Yeah.
He says that when he became governor in 79, he started really moving and trying to figure out what to do with the gorge. So specifically, when Friends of the Gorge comes together 2 years later, he's saying, well, I was there before they were, that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's whatever.
Yeah.
But I can't find any documentation of him doing anything. There's one person I need to interview more in depth on that. That's Pat Amadeo.
I was about to say,
exactly.
Pat would be the best person.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's got, he has daily cards, 3x5 cards he put in his pocket.
Really?
So that's how I know all your meetings.
Yeah.
Because you're there.
Yeah.
You can't say, you know, there you, everybody walks in.
Yeah.
But I can't find anything going on. During that first 2 years, though, the big thing for him is energy, Northwest Power Planning Council, and salmon is a huge part of that. So, you know, there's all those kinds of things going on.
Yeah.
So I also had a wonderful interview with Roy Hemingway. I'm getting all that, right. That side of things.
Yeah.
So that first 2 years, I don't know. I'll have to figure that more of it out.
Yeah.
But the key things that he says that he played a role in, he is the one who got Spellman to sign on. And the assertion is that without Spellman, the Washington delegation wouldn't have come on. And since the Washington delegation, you got no votes whatsoever the first round, there's something to explore there.
Sure.
Okay? So there's building that. The second part is the actual signing. It's not clear if he called or the White House called him, but he did have a heart-to-heart with Andy Card, as far as I can figure out, who was that kind of person.
Yeah.
Explained, you know, Reagan thought that as a good Republican, Vic would want it vetoed.
Yeah.
And Vic said, made it very clear, absolutely not. And the thing is signed on the last day.
Yeah.
But there's other stories, which I can't find any documentation on. It was Hatfield holding up nuclear stuff.
And, yeah.
You know, all these other kinds of things. And so, any light?
Sure. I should start by saying that I don't think Governor Attia played a strong role in getting legislation through. I think he actually was a hindrance at many stages. And that's coming from me with my bias
as
director of Friends of the Columbia Gorge at that point and trying to get as much support as we can. I think you're absolutely right that Governor Attia cared about the gorge. And he expressed that to me many a time, including I interviewed him not too long ago for a book I'm doing about Nancy Russell. But when you look at his actions, they uniformly were not, I think, promoting protection of the gorge. And I've wondered why that is. And let me give you a few examples. The appointments that he made to the Gorge Commission, universally he would not reappoint the strongest appointees.
Right.
People who disagreed with him were gone after a short amount of time. Kate McCarthy was one, Vera Defoe was the other, and they really stick out. I don't remember Governor Attia ever weighing in on some of the key state developments that were problematic, whether it was the port of entry that was originally proposed for the Sandy River Delta and ended up in Cascade Locks, or the historic Columbia River Highway's Hood River Bridge, which was a historic feature that ended up being destroyed, or the Oregon Dunes in the east side of the gorge that were covering the interstate. And you know, there were proposals to essentially put up fencing and other things so that the dunes would stay there, but instead the dunes were covered. So those were kind of examples. And then the legislation or the concepts that he introduced that became the governor's bill was Spellman, which set up a very challenging structure of, I think, 23 commissioners.
Which quickly got cut
to 12 or 14, but had many of the same problems when it was introduced in the legislation that the Lake Tahoe legislation had, the deemed approved, the local preponderance of commissioners. So, you know, I look at all that and think, here's a governor from Oregon where there was tremendous political support for legislation and very little's wrong, but little comparatively opposition.
Right.
And so there were huge political upsides to being a strong protector. And there were few political downsides. So then let me kind of address the issue of Governor Spellman. Before Governor Spellman, Governor Attia was pleased that he was able to get Dixie Lee Ray, Washington's governor at that point, to sign on to a letter that the Washington Gorge Commission ended up approving, and he thought the Oregon Gorge Commission would too. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, the letter was drafted saying both commissions have approved before the commission actually met to endorse it. And then two of the commissioners missed the commission meeting, so McCarthy and Defoe carried it and opposed the letter, the Washington Gorge Commission letter. But basically that letter was very clear, and this was probably 1980, 1981. I can get the exact dates for you. But that letter, what Governor Attia also believed in, taking him at face value that he cared for the gorge, he had a very strong anti-federal bias.
Yeah.
And he told us that that came from incidents at Rogue River and Hell's Canyon. So, you know, there must have been some reason for it. But to carry over that sort of bias in the Columbia Gorge, where there was no protective solution that didn't have a federal lead role, just meant you weren't interested in protecting the gorge. So if you were interested, and I want to be careful here and give them this too, if you were interested, you weren't willing to take, I think, to take a leadership role that would allow it to happen.
Right.
And he, as you know, Governor Attia changed his position three times in the course of, I think, 15 months, from no feds to a bi-state compact to federal leadership. Mm-hmm. And so that's the history that kind of I was part of. And, mm-hmm. and so that makes me think, okay, even if he cared about the Gorge, which I think he did, mm-hmm. You know, having met with him, he wasn't willing to support a solution that would have made it happen. So then the question is, okay, was this because he wanted to get Spellman on board and mm-hmm. Ray on board before that? Was that part of the strategy? And if it was, he never revealed that to us.
Right.
And I think there would have been a real benefit to doing that, because then we would have said, okay, we wouldn't have been as challenging in the public arena and as kind of a demanding if we said, okay, this is part of the strategy. Let's go easy on this, see how it plays out. But I think I don't tend to believe that was the major reason that Governor Attia took those positions. I really think it was more his kind of anti-federal bias mm-hmm. that did it. And, you know, as a governor of a state, I can understand that, you know, yeah. thinking that the state ought to be the solution. And if the state can't do it, then the feds have to be. But if you're talking about a bi-state area with a considerable federal role, there mm-hmm. has to be a federal solution in it. And so getting back to, okay, well, he was pleased when he brought Dixie Lee Ray on board the Washington Gorge Commission letter. Mm-hmm. But basically, all that was saying, I like the existing system. The Gorge Commissions are going to work.
Right.
They make right. a lot of sense. We can solve this with the Gorge Commissions if we give them a little more money.
Mm-hmm.
And that was crazy, because mm-hmm. the Gorge Commissions were advisory only.
Right.
And even the commissions, at least the candid members of the commission, were admitting that they weren't getting anything done. And then Governor Attia didn't support increased funding for the Gorge Commissions, which was, again, his preferred way of saying
right.
we're going to do things.
Right.
So I don't put a lot of confidence and faith in the argument that he was trying to take a lesser position in order to have the greater
right.
goal of bringing Washington on board. And finally, even if that was his strategy, and what he did with Dixie Lee Ray, the solution there would have been horrible for the Gorge.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just advisory Gorge Commission,
mm-hmm.
so that wasn't going to work. And then a second position of a bi-state compact, that would be a little better, but still we have a problem that we have on the commission today, that we would end up in kind of the lowest common denominator
right.
of protection, and you wouldn't have federal authority that could take care of the federal issues. But finally, even if that's what you were trying to do and you saw that as a good thing, that doesn't allow for what eventually happened. And the reason we were able to get Gorge legislation passed is just there was a changing of the guard politically,
yeah.
where Dan Evans replaced Scoop Jackson
right.
and Booth Gardner replaced Governor Spellman.
Yeah.
And so that, when we had that, then we had the support for strong legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, we certainly appreciate when Governors Attia would say things like in the State of the Union address that the Gorge was really important and
mm-hmm.
we had to get this fixed. And he was getting closer.
Four times in a row.
Did he really?
Four State of the States in a row.
I didn't realize
yeah.
that.
Yeah, 83 to his
yeah,
last one.
That's, which again makes me think that, you know, some people, some politicians I'm cynical about, in fact, they're just saying that. I don't think that was true with Governor Attia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really seemed to care about the Gorge.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was just political gamesmanship.
Mm-hmm.
But whether because of this anti-federal bias or because of something else, he just never played, I think, the role that would have pushed strong, comprehensive
right.
legislation
right.
together.
Now, is that... I mean, the whole history of it with Hatfield and Packwood doing the first bill and then Hatfield immediately turning around and doing another bill.
Yeah.
There's some weird stuff going on here.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to get into Hatfield and Packwood archives, but we can't.
Yeah.
How did that dynamic play out? Did you see it playing out so that, I mean, Vic eventually kind of goes the Hatfield route, basically.
Yeah.
But
he did.
How did you see that playing out? I mean, was this a Vicatia as a side player? Was it mainly the senators?
Yes.
I mean, what was going on with this?
That's exactly what it was. I mean, there was, it's a little more complicated than that. You had Senator Hatfield in the beginning vacillating a little bit, mm-hmm. and a little uncertain what he wanted to do. And you had Senator Packwood really pushing for the strongest possible protection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of that was undoubtedly political. Mm-hmm. Some of it was, you know, heartfelt. But there was a lot of politics there. And Senator Packwood, it was easier for Senator Packwood to take a really strong pro-conservation position,
mm-hmm.
because he wasn't on the key committees.
Right.
So we knew it was going to ultimately be Senator Hatfield. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, Packwood for a lot of that was chairman of finance, so he had a lot of authority. You know, staffers referred to Packwood and Hatfield as the 800-pound gorillas, and they right. were. And so that was in the Senate. In the House, we had a Democratic House, and we had strong support from the Oregon delegation. We mm-hmm. had Jim Weaver, and Les Acoin.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them, Acoin was, I think, subcommittee chair of appropriations, and Weaver was on Interior. And then we had kind of Bob and Denny Smith, who were out of it a little bit to
yeah.
a large degree. You know, we had support on the Washington side in the House. We had Don Bonker,
mm-hmm.
who was really good on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had other Seattle representatives who were also very good, but also were way away from the gorge and
yeah.
didn't have. Bonker had part of the gorge in his district, so
okay.
that was a pretty brave position.
That's one of Vic's observations, is that the power center in Washington is so far away.
He's exactly
they've
right.
They've never seen the thing even.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And so what we did as Friends of the Columbia Gorge was we saw that and built support in Washington State up in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
where it would make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So we had very strong leadership in the House, mostly in Oregon, but also in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
We had very strong support in the Senate, initially only in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the issue was, as you identified, how do you get Washington on board? And Scoop Jackson was kind of, he had a really close relationship to Hatfield, but
mm-hmm.
he had been burned before
mm-hmm.
on issues up in Forks, Washington, on the
mm-hmm.
Olympic Peninsula and other places. So he was really being careful. And Mark Hatfield was really being careful. I mean, he had told Nancy Russell way back when that if you form the army, and it's got to be a diverse army, people on both sides of the river, both
right.
ends of the gorge, conservationist business people, I'll lead it for you. And but he still wasn't really out there. And you're absolutely right, the fact that he put in Senate Bill 627, then immediately put in a weaker bill and kind of said, I'm doing this to because people in the gorge feel strongly about this and they don't like the federal control. So, you know, so Hatfield was still,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of looking around. And then I think what it took was a few things. It took Nancy Russell building this Friends of the Columbia Gorge Army. It took Russell's personal relationship with Hatfield, which ended up being very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And it took kind of eventually a changing of the guard in
right.
the congressional delegation in Washington State to make Hatfield into the very strong supporter he was.
Right.
And you always had Bob Packwood out there, who was pushing for
right.
the strongest iteration of whatever bill came. I mean, Hatfield was pushing for the tributaries being included, the National Park Service being lead agency, not the Forest Service. I'm sorry, Packwood was pushing
yeah.
for that. And Hatfield was, you know, being pushed and pulled because of the relationship and because he saw that this had become a really important issue in
mm-hmm.
Oregon. And again, the political downside of supporting Gore's legislation as an Oregon senator was not great.
No.
It really wasn't.
No.
So that's in my perception how it all came together. And
yeah.
And I think
so. But why then do you get no votes from the Washington delegation in the first round?
Well, I'm trying to think back when we started getting the votes. But the first round, probably because, you know, the issue was still we hadn't been able to build up the support in the Washington constituency. And we started doing things like, you know, hanging doorknob hangers on 5,000, 10,000 homes in Vancouver. And we created an office in Vancouver. So, you know, that takes time.
Mm-hmm. And clever to pick Skamania and
yeah, they were just well.
Skamania's the whole other world.
They ended up being the perfect opponents.
Yeah,
because they misled kind of what was happening.
Yeah.
And they pissed off Mark Hatfield, and it just didn't.
And
make
they
sense.
Do that to this day.
They do.
It's
they
amazing.
Still do. It is a lot of shooting in the foot.
Yeah.
But I think it was building the constituency.
Yeah.
And then, you know, slowly getting Don Bonker on. You know, we fought so hard to get the Vancouver City Council to endorse the National Scenic Area concept.
Right.
And once that happened, that gave cover to people like Bonker, who was right in the middle, who had, you know, a really difficult Clark County constituency, some of whom wanted legislation, many of whom didn't. And that gave him kind of the support and the cover that I think ended up making a big difference.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the big thing that was happening then at that time that was raising the profile of the issue and that Skamania County was playing perfectly into was these plethora of subdivisions that were coming into the western Skamania County, which was totally unzoned, where you had Rimview Estates on top of Cape Horn, you had the Riser subdivision across from Multnomah Falls, you had Hidden Harbor subdivision and marina across from Multnomah Falls, and all those were just approved willy-nilly by Skamania County. So suddenly, this issue has got not just local, but regional and national significance.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew if we could nationalize the issue, that the national conservation groups could deliver the senators from, you know, Texas, back in those days, you know, Texas, New York, Massachusetts, because for them, it was a no-brainer. You get the environmental vote, you save this great area.
And being Bob Smith's big problem. It's it's not them.
Exactly.
It's our neighborhood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if you have two of the most senior Republican senators supporting it, then, you know, in the Senate, it becomes a no-brainer. And it was. I mean, we could have been stopped time and time again in the Senate. But it was, Hatfield going for unanimous consent to getting it through the committee, to get it to pass by the Senate. So, and all that, I think, was a product of Mark Hatfield being, initially vacillating, and then stronger and stronger and stronger, and then finally, he just took it upon himself and said, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And that, you know, again, the politics were favorable for him there. Bob Packwood was pushing him. We had the House pushing him there. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it came together, I think. I don't think Spellman, I never saw Spellman coming on board as that important in the overall.
Yeah. Well, it's a congressional thing, and so it's a.
Yeah.
It's a weird mix.
It is.
It's a very weird mix.
Yeah.
The importance then of the governor's meeting where they bring everybody together and say, let's hammer stuff out.
That was a critical meeting.
Okay.
And that was, and I've never fully understood how that meeting came together. You know, Joe Mentor from Senator Evans' staff played probably the leadership role, along with Tom Imeson, in having that Olympia meeting turn into legislation.
Right.
And to the extent that Vicatia was helpful in that, more power to him. I just don't know how that meeting particularly came together. A person you could talk to about that, because it's an interesting question, would be Jeff Breckel, who used to be the director of the Gorge Commission.
Okay.
And he was, he was really involved with that, needless to say.
What I'm looking for is here, Pat Amodeo memo, shortly thereafter, when, because she and Imason and Mentor were working together on all this stuff.
That's right. I think Pat was really involved.
Working on this, that, and the other. Packwood staff, notably, nowhere to be seen.
Wasn't John Stevens involved with that?
She doesn't remember any Packwood staff at all.
I think he was there, because I think he gave me that memo.
Uh-huh. So this is, where is it? AO forestry rollback. Yeah, I'm not finding it here. Oh, here, proposed Gorge legislation. That would be the big thing.
Yeah.
Right there. So 23rd of September, they're putting all this stuff together. 85.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
But you go through, and it's got like 14 points, which pretty much become the bill.
They do.
Yeah.
That's right.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've got a copy of that somewhere. I should look. But it's that was absolutely important. And if you look at kind of where, you're right. The bill came out of that memo.
Yeah. But why the meeting took place?
I think the meeting took place because we were at a standstill.
Okay.
And Evans was really getting irritated. He was really frustrated. He felt he was being an honest broker and that he was being attacked by the interest groups.
Okay.
And he was ready to walk away.
Right.
And
so
this
he put pressure on the governors. They have a meeting.
Yeah, and again, I don't know if it was pressure on the governors. I don't know who. I could see Pat Amodeo being the key person saying, we've got to have this meeting.
Yeah.
But I think it was Dan Evans who was ready to walk away, and the delegation got together. We were totally out of the loop on this. The delegation got together and said, okay, let's try one last thing. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being this weird combination synthesis
of the different classic positions. Bargaining. We'll take two of these, four of those, put them together.
Yeah. We'll have commission, we'll have lead agency, we'll have general management areas, we'll have special management areas.
So. The contrast for me, because Pat makes it clear that it was easier to do this, even though it was really, really hard, simply because when ATIA comes in, almost immediately they start doing the Northwest Power Planning thing, which is a similar multi-state. There's four states in that.
Yeah.
You know, how do you make it legal with the feds? Who do you talk to? The staffers. You know, Pat was a staffer par excellence, and you know, the same staffers. And so when it came to this, it's like they kind of knew the language.
Yeah.
Knew where they were going.
And don't forget, of course, Dan Evans had a real background in that.
When Dan Evans gets elected, you know, it's like, boom, well, you know, he was the first head of the Northern Power Planning.
Exactly.
Got something with him and McCall in like 1970 saying, by God, we've got to have a gorge something here.
Yeah.
So it's like, he's clearly a key player.
Yeah.
But
you're right, Pat Amodeo really, it was clear to me that she was a critical factor in that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that meeting did end up, you know, creating legislation, creating the structure of the legislation by and large.
Yeah. So why did the president sign it?
I'm
any ideas?
Convinced, yeah. I mean, I'm convinced it was because of Star Wars. And
okay.
Don Bonker has told me that.
Okay.
You know, he said that he had a personal call with Hatfield, and he and Don were pretty close socially. And he said that Hatfield, and you know Mark Hatfield isn't going to say, I told the president if he wants Star Wars through, he needed to get
the Department of Gorge.
Yeah, exactly. But you also know that Hatfield could make himself very clear in a diplomatic way.
Yeah.
So what I have been told by different sources is that, yes, Hatfield made it clear to Reagan that if he wanted funding for the Strategic Arms Initiative, or that's the wrong phrase, but essentially Star Wars, that he's going to need to let the legislation go through.
Mm-hmm.
And it came down, as you say, to the very last day.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, despite a real lobbying campaign.
Yeah, but it's also fascinating to me because then the Washington delegation is unanimous.
Yeah.
And in Oregon, we've got our two libertarians saying, no, I don't think so.
Yeah. And I had never heard that, and you know, at Friends, we were reaching out to all the people we had who had relationships in the administration.
Right.
And those were people like Bob Wilson, who was chairman of Weyerhaeuser, Brad Bishop, chairman of Pendleton, and, you know, a lot of... I'm trying to think of the name of the guy who was Standard Insurance, Bob Frisbee, and others. So we had good, strong Republican businessmen approaching the administration. And most of them had relationships with Bush and not Reagan.
Right.
So we were doing that. But I'm convinced it was Mark Hatfield.
Yeah.
And the rest of it was just noise. And I hadn't heard that Governor Attia had talked with Andy Card until I talked with him a few years ago, where he mentioned that. So
did that happen? I've got a near contemporary newspaper article where he talks about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
And so that to me says yes. I think the call absolutely happened.
I think
he
you're
said
right.
It's Don Regan in his memory. It's Jim Baker, who was not anywhere near it. Pat's really convinced it's Card. I think it's Card.
Yeah, and he
it makes sense.
And Governor Attia had told me the chief of staff, and he wasn't quite remembering who it was. So
right.
There was that ambiguity there.
Yeah.
I also saw that.
Yeah.
That's great. I think ultimately though it was Hatfield.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
Well, which would make sense.
Yeah.
Chairman
among
of Appropriations. Things, you know, when this book comes out, people are going to be stunned and how nasty Vic was to Ronald Reagan.
Really?
He ran his 1982 campaign. He was directly running against Ronald Reagan.
Is that
on
right?
The campaign trail? He'd go out there and say, "Darn this! You know, the budget deficit, interest rates.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything." So that David Broder was coming out here saying, "Who is this Republican who's running against Reagan?"
Interesting.
So it's fascinating. And like all the people that you named, his relationship was with Bush.
Yeah.
1980, when Reagan is nominated, nobody, Packwood doesn't go, Hatfield doesn't go, Attia doesn't go, Norma Paulus doesn't go, nobody goes to the National Convention.
Interesting.
It's all the social conservatives, because Reagan is not these guys.
And it all stems from that.
It all stems from that, and I've got stuff where the Bush Vice President office would call and warn Attia about certain things.
Interesting.
Just to let him know, you know, X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's a fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
The whole Gorge legislation and the politics swirling is just fascinating to me. Was then and still is.
Yeah. So talk to me about how you got involved with this. Were you in the Gorge?
I was interested in college and doing environmental work, and I figured law would be the best way to do it. So I went to from the East Coast to Northwestern, Lewis and Clark.
Okay.
Got my law degree, spent two interminable years practicing law, just really didn't like it, and was always looking for something in conservation. The Friends of the Columbia Gorge advertised the position of executive director, and I applied for it and ended up getting it. I wasn't the first executive director. That was Carol Kirshner, and she was leaving. And so
this is 81-ish, 82-ish?
Yeah, this would have been, let me get the exact, it would have been 82.
Mm-hmm.
December of 82, I want to say, let me just see. I was looking at my resume for other reasons. So I was hired in Friends of the Columbia Gorge in late 1982.
Okay.
So I think it was December, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that. And it was just a dream come true for me. I just loved it. I had no, you know, background in politics or anything, but I think the law degree helped me land the position.
Yeah.
And it ended up working out really well for me. And then I So I did that through legislation. I stayed a little longer, ended up being on the board of Friends of the Columbia Gorge and starting an office for the Trust for Public Land here in Oregon. And then I ran their land acquisition nationally for 20-plus years. And now I'm on the Gorge Commission.
Okay.
So that's been fun. I feel like I've kind of come full circle.
Yeah, I've got a little bit about your land acquisition, because there was that highly critical Oregon Historical Quarterly story. It was about Bridal Veil.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. And it's like, you know, that's fine. I don't care one way or the other. But the fascinating thing to me is, so you guys buy the buildings, basically, and ditch them.
Yeah.
Another side to this is Opal Creek.
Yes.
Because that's Dick's family.
Yes.
And George, what happened, George was the key guy. But Tom Atiyah, Vic's son, was also, in the early days, they were like the president and vice president of this company.
Yeah.
They were doing all these things. Probably putting sugar in machines and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
But in the middle of this wilderness area, so it's not the gorge, it's an actual wilderness area, the buildings stand.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's just an amazing place.
It's an amazing place, but with very different decisions and outcomes and the way it played out.
Yeah, and it was the you know, without getting off on Bridal Veil, what we felt was, unlike Opal Creek, the buildings at Bridal Veil were not historic. Mm-hmm. There were some that clearly were that had been taken down. It was a historic area, but the main warehouses that were blocking the view of Bridal Veil Falls, those were just huge, you know, kind of derelict buildings. They were used for car chop operations, actually, while we owned it, which we didn't realize at the time. Not a good thing. And the church was relatively recent. People told us the post office was a great example of some sort of architectural vernacular. And so we did a historic survey on it, and the guy came back and said, no, this was bought out of a Sears Roebuck catalog in 1955 and stuff. So so there were historic elements to Bridal Veil, but most of that had gone.
But
you're right, we angered a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that's kind of the way things are in the gorge.
Yeah, it is.
It's the nature of the beast.
And it still is.
Yeah. So you're now on the commission. You've looked at this from afar.
Yeah.
So I ask you the same question I asked Roy Hemingway and then current people who are on the Northwest Power Planning Council. How has this system worked?
I think it's worked pretty well. And I say that because we were very concerned with the idea of a commission managing land use in the gorge. We saw the Tahoe example, which from a conservation standpoint had been a total failure.
Right.
And we saw the history of protecting the gorge going back to the early 1900s as being one of acrimony and having two states, as you said earlier, with very different interests in the gorge. So we were really worried about a commission. So what we did is, knowing that a commission was going to be a big part of this, we made sure that the act itself was very specific when it came to how the landscape was going to be protected. Mm-hmm. We put in language that had not been seen in any other federal bill proscribing how the gorge would be managed. We had things like a 40-acre minimum lot size in the special management areas. And that drove the conservatives crazy. But that's what ultimately made us feel comfortable with the commission.
Mm-hmm.
We essentially figured, how much damage can a commission or the Forest Service do if the act itself is very clear and restrictive? And so that's what we bet on.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, it's been a pretty good bet. There have been things that we didn't anticipate that have been problems there. Certainly holes in legislation. Mm-hmm. It wasn't perfect. The Forest Service has ended up being more cautious as an agency than perhaps we expected, although our expectations weren't especially high. But the commission, in some respects, it's been uneven because the appointments make such a difference.
Yeah.
And there's some years when the appointments are really strong from a conservation standpoint and other times when they're not. Probably the biggest area that's that's been a problem has been funding the Gorge Commission.
Yeah.
And you have what it comes down to, because it's the whatever state gives the lowest amount of money to support the Gorge Commission, that is the de facto budget amount that the two states will contribute to. So if Oregon's willing to do $5 million and Washington's only $1 million, then both states contribute $1 million and that's it. And that's been a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one that clearly needs
maybe the one vote changing. Blue wall will make a difference now.
The one vote blue wall?
There was a big thing because they just had the special election up in Washington State. So
yeah.
Washington now has two houses that are Democratic.
Yes, that's
so
right. Talking
about the blue wall of the West Coast.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And so
that could make a huge difference. But then when that happens, often Oregon kind of backslides.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Oregon, Washington, and California, but for that matter. But they're all, because of healthcare, living beyond their means.
Yeah.
Having to cut.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't look like it's going to get much better.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. So I think that's something that certainly we didn't anticipate. We didn't spend as much time thinking about as we should have.
Fascinating to me, because as time goes on in this whole process, regardless of the role Vic is playing, he gets more and more and more fed up with the Forest Service.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's because of the recession year, you know, the ability to help small towns, the logging industry. It never goes away.
Yeah.
It's basically, I've just found something I've got to peg down. He is, in that 1982 election, he names David Stockman all the time.
Is that right?
This guy's just a devil incarnate.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to chase down is, in Vic's last year, 1986, every year the governor goes back to D.C. to talk to the people who do bonds.
Yeah.
David Stockman. He talks to Goldman Sachs, and David Stockman's one of the people he talks to.
Interesting.
And I've got to figure out, so what did you guys do?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting.
So he just gets more and more frustrated with the Reagan administration, with basically the forest being looked as a way to balance the budget rather than whatever it is that we need.
You mean by overcutting?
Yeah, by overcutting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, Senator Hatfield was supporting a lot
you
of
betcha.
That, too.
Yeah. You betcha. One last little bit. Vic gets really involved in a private effort to buy the lower part of the Deschutes River.
Interesting.
And then it extends now. It's like it goes up to Pelton Dam.
Yeah.
It wasn't any state money, but he was the head cheerleader. He put it together. They did the first part of it. Like Blitz Weinhardt was having contests and all this stuff. And it's an amazing thing. It's a state park. The Park Service runs it.
Yeah.
There's public access to the, because you can't fish in the river. You've got a fish standing on the banks.
Yeah.
And there's public access the whole way. It's fantastic.
And
Andy Kerr's comment was, man, if only we could have got him out more, we could have saved a lot more valuable parts of Oregon.
I remember.
Because that's his favorite river.
Yeah, I remember that that campaign, too.
Yeah.
I was thinking of something while you were saying that about Governor T and some other. Oh, yeah. He was also very good with tribes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and people don't appreciate that.
No.
And he had a knowledge and relationship with tribes and with Native people that I think would be hard to find parallels with in Oregon's history.
Yeah, and not only that, but so the tribes are incredibly important. I've been trying to figure out why. The best hypothesis, and there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, there was a guy named Sam Johnson, Betsy Johnson's dad.
Yeah.
And Sam Johnson had the mill on the reservation. In 67, he sold it to them. He and Vic were like this.
Yeah, I know.
And so I think that's the beginning of it.
Interesting.
But at Vic's memorial service, Dellis Heath, who's the chief.
Warm Springs.
Yeah. Of Warm Springs. He said, you know, when we started becoming really close to Vic Atiyah is we had been asking governors to come to Paiumsha, their annual Treaty Day celebration.
Yeah.
And Vic was the first one to go.
Yeah. I believe it. Yeah.
And that combined with he is the one who pushed for and created the Legislative Tribal Commission.
Interesting.
Which no one done. And so by 82, he's having annual meetings at least. I'm finding evidence of a lot more meetings.
Yeah.
Sovereign to sovereign meetings.
Yeah.
And the tribes just said, you're the guy.
Yeah.
You're the guy.
And I always attributed it to the fact that he was Syrian and maybe a bit of an outsider, but I, you know, who knows?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Other people have observed that.
Yeah.
I was never able to grill him on that.
Yeah.
His older brother just died.
Did he?
And so I grilled him on it. And his stance was, no, we were Americans.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
And we were Americans.
And I never thought of him, and I knew him
thinking
of himself as Syrian, but I wondered.
But, yeah, I think there's a lot to that, but pegging it down is tough.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah, but
he,
it's amazing.
He worked with Johnson in 1980 for the Oregon Historical Society to come out with a letter opposing federal involvement in the Gorge.
Oh, yeah.
And hell broke loose then, because Johnson wrote it on Oregon Historical Society stationery.
Right.
And John Yon and just a dozen people just were furious.
Yeah.
And poor Tom Vaughn.
Yeah.
Yeah, was caught in the middle. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a funny story.
Huh, that's wild.
Yeah.
And but it would make perfect sense with Johnson.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, with Betsy, too.
Yeah.
You know, what's the role there? You know, I'm still stunned that the Johnson family owns the headwaters of Natolius.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
But and it's a way of thinking.
Yeah. And Governor Atiyah was also pretty close to the timber industry, I'm thinking, as any Republican governor would
be. Yeah, he was. It was really funky. In 78, he's running in the primary against McCall. And then this other guy, Roger Martin, who was the minority leader in the House.
Hmm.
So a little sidelight. Ted Ferrioli just left. Mike McClain is the other minority leader in the House. And I think they're just awful. Back in the day, those were the guys who would have run for governor.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that in the Republican side at that level. We just haven't seen that now in 35 years.
Yeah.
Just stunning.
Really true.
But in any case, he's running, and the timber industry has a big dinner, and they announce, we're putting together $300,000 to $400,000 for Bob Straub because he's going to beat Tom McCall in the general election.
Really?
And Vic beats McCall in the primary.
Yeah.
Stuns everybody. And the week after, the timber industry spokesman says, we're giving $300,000 to $400,000 to Vic Atiyah.
Funny.
And you know, Ted Kulongoski was watching this. He was going to run 2 years later, or 4 years later.
Yeah.
2 years later against Packwood. For him, it was just a tremendous situational ethics in politics.
Yeah.
You know, your friends are your friends until there's somewhere
something
else they
happens.
Can go.
Yeah. That's so true.
Yeah. So Vic was close to the timber industry, but he had a really interesting relationship. The very first thing he told me when I started interviewing him, started talking about blue ribbon commissions and the business community, because he's a downtown retailer.
Yeah.
But he was never in the inner sanctum of anything.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so they thought that they had this guy in their pocket.
Mm.
And he basically told them, jump off a bridge.
Yeah.
And so there's a fascinating, and it's with the timber industry, it's with a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
So it's just
established
interests
and businesses.
Yeah.
Yeah. He seemed like just a thoroughly decent person.
He
really did.
He was.
Low-keyed, and he really objected. He had a good sense of morality, and he objected to people who were pushing themselves. And
right.
He was just, and that was really a wonderful quality, and particularly nice for the state of Oregon, I think.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
He hated Goldschmidt. I remember when I talked with him. That was the one thing. You know, we talked about Nancy Russell. He was annoyed at Nancy, but he was very clear to say, you know, I respected her,
right.
And
Packwood told me that it's because he really disliked Nancy Russell. I was like, I don't think he disliked Nancy Russell.
I don't think so either. I mean, no. What he accused Nancy of being, he called her 110%.
Right. I've got great stuff where he's saying, don't push so hard, you're going to break it.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
But she kept pushing.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing she did.
Yeah.
But man, he just out of the blue. Just said, you know, I didn't hate anybody. And then he thought about it. I said, well, except for a former governor. And then he said Goldschmidt.
Yeah.
And it makes perfect sense because it offends his morality.
His dislike for Goldschmidt, I mean, there's probably other things, but the main political reason is Goldschmidt, when he was mayor, really didn't, I mean, he was anti-ATIA.
Was he?
Well, he's this Washington County guy. He kept an office and a store
important.
Right there.
Yeah, and he never came and...
You know, Goldschmidt just said, oh, Washington guy, suburb guy, blah, blah, blah. It's like,
He's
as Portland as anybody.
Yeah.
And Portland downtown as anybody.
Yeah.
And it just kept going like that. So there was, before your time, there's the Mount Hood Freeway.
Yeah. I remember reading
that. So Mount Hood Freeway doesn't go in. Vic becomes governor, and he says, you know, it's 4 years dead, but can I revive it? And within a day, he found out he could if he got an act of Congress. He said, well, that's dead. It's not going anywhere. But there was the money that had gone to the county, the city, and to basically pay their part of this.
Yeah.
Goldschmidt was really pushing light rail.
Yeah,
and so Vic, as governor-elect, goes in and has a meeting, and he turns to his aide and says, I'm just going to see how much Neil wants his train. And so the deal was, there was money for the train from the state, but that pot of money goes to the state to use for transportation projects for the entire state.
Interesting.
So real hardcore bargaining.
Yeah.
And just amazing.
Yeah. Vic Atiyah wasn't he really good on land use, too?
Yeah. He's, in fact, Earl Blumenauer, who was there at the birth of land use, says that Vic is the one who saved it.
Yeah.
Because people simply, the counties and cities weren't doing their plans.
Yeah.
And he came in, and the reason he did it is he saw it as economic development before the recessions.
Yeah.
It's economic development. We got to have certainty so businesses can come here and know what's going to happen with the land.
Yeah.
Then he went for things like one-stop permitting.
Yeah.
And then he gets the foreign, you know, the Japanese to come in and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, land use was a key thing.
And I remember Henry Richmond, who was director of 1,000 Friends, you know, way back then, but even more recently, you know, always having good words about Vic Atiyah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because my perspective was different with the Gorge, and of course that was federal again, and given that kind of anti-federal, but Henry always, and Henry, you know, doesn't throw compliments around, and he always was very high on Governor Atiyah.
Yeah. And in Vic's mind, looking at the Gorge, he saw it as Oregon, because it had land use planning, better positioned no matter what to deal with its side, but we had to look at Washington.
Yeah.
So how do we go? And I don't think... You know, I don't think he was able to come up with any solution. I think it was totally, you know, the federal stuff there.
Yeah.
But that difference was really clear to him.
Yeah.
Really, really clear.
Yeah, it's true. Makes sense. Well, I was sorry to see him pass on.
Yeah. Yeah. With the tribes, I just finally got 3 sources on it, so it'll be in the book. Members of the tribes were there when he died.
Is that right?
So it's his family, closest friends, tribes. So I'd heard from one of the close friends, but I couldn't get any verification.
Yeah.
And I just finally pushed, because I saw a picture of his private funeral, and I said, I've got to get this.
Yeah.
When he died, the tribes wrapped him in a tree blanket.
Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know if that went into the coffin with him or not.
Yeah.
But it was a tremendous honor.
Yeah.
The reason I was pushing on it, because I saw then his coffin at the family funeral. Had an Atiyah rug over it.
Interesting.
It's like, you know, people are wrapping him.
Yeah.
There's something going on here.
Yeah. All you have to have done was be in his office, though, and I'm not talking about a Salem office, I'm thinking more about his personal office.
Yeah.
To understand the depth of connection with tribes. Okay. And Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. It's stunning stuff.
Yeah. Great. Well, you've got a great book on your hands, Jim.
Yeah. No, if you want to know where the kicker really came from, I got that too.
The kicker?
Yeah, the kicker. Our tax law.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That is just nuts.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've got that.
I just, it's too bad we don't have a sales tax. How did Vic Attia?
He pushed one finally. He posed them forever, and he finally pushed it. There was a special election in 85, and it, like everything else, got hammered.
Yeah.
OEA had their own plan, so they came out in 86, and it got hammered.
Yeah.
God,
is the state ever going to have a sales tax?
Yeah. No. It's just stunning all the stuff now with Measure 101 and taxing insurance and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I've got all this stuff from 1986 where he's meeting with people about taxing insurance.
Is that right?
It's like, as he said...
Deja vu all over
again. Because he was on the task committees from his very first day in 1959 in the legislature.
Was he?
Yeah. And so, you know, there's only so many taxes and so many people you can tax.
Yeah.
It's not that complex.
Yeah.
Amen. Politically, it sure is, but it just isn't that complex.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Jim. I hope I helped somewhat. Thank you for making the effort for coming down.